Hi there, and a word right from the get-go. This is a podcast-only episode, so no language is bleeped, and there is some graphic depictions of some very adult behavior well beyond what you'd hear on the radio. So, take that advice and make a choice. From the independent producer project of KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is a special podcast extra episode of Unfictional. Unfictional is true stories, personal documentaries, and on this episode, it's the winners from the 5th annual KCRW 24-hour radio race. On the morning of August 19th, hundreds of radio producers, some newly minted, some old hands, all received a message with a link to a video. This video.
Record out in the world where life is happening, but don't record next to a fountain.
Okay, here's the theme. It's down for whatever, and you can interpret that however you want.
There were 265 teams and 414 people total who participated this year. 7 different countries, 30 U.S. states, 136 pieces made it to the finish line. The rules were these. Teams had 24 hours to make a radio story on the theme, down for whatever. And over the next 24 hours, the submissions poured in.
In the water, you're surrounded by a solid wall of indigo. It glows somehow.
Okay, I don't know what that was.
And I just remember thinking, like, you know, why did I spend so much money on an outfit if I'm just going to be covered in snacks?
I just wasn't that great at being a responsible person.
Nobody wanted to give any documents to someone who's going to marry a capitalist foreigner.
I'm like, also, why do I have snacks on my neck? Like, is this going to go that long?
You can find a link to all of this year's 24-hour radio race submissions at our website, all at kcrw.com/unfictional. And now to the prize-winning stories. Third place this year was made by a team called Team Question Mark, and it's quite an intimate, some might say, explicit topic. And in fact, a warning that this piece is very explicit, so skip this one if you might be offended.
All I could think about is like, oh my God, I just had 20 guys come at me. Holy fuck, what did I just do?
This is John.
Well, usually I'm here like handing out free condoms, but ta-da!
And this is not the story of his first time in a bathhouse.
I just want to feel welcomed or wanted. That's what it started as.
John used to work in HIV prevention. While he loved his job, it caused a lot of problems in his sex life.
I was definitely feeling bad about my self-image. You know, I couldn't meet people because of the work I did. Like, I knew a lot of people and everyone knew me, but that was kind of the problem.
Looking for sex and anonymity, the next step seemed logical.
So eventually I went to a bathhouse and I just said, you know what? Fuck it. I don't care who's there. I don't care what's there. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to have an experience and see what I like, what I don't like.
For people like me, straight woman in the room.
This is my co-producer, Lane.
I guess some straight girls do this, but I've never been to any kind of sex club or bathhouse. Could you explain the typical setting?
When you walk in, you are immediately in a room where it's just like a glass panel where it tells you the prices, where everything is. They ask for your ID. You have to sign some paperwork saying, you know that it's a private club. There's going to be sexual acts. There's going to be nudity. So you give them all your information. They put you in the system and then they buzz you in. Like, it's almost like a prison door. Like, you have to be buzzed in. When you get to the other side, it's like a small little gym just because that's what they say they are, is a gym, but that's not really what they are. And then you get your towel. And then in this particular one, you have to go upstairs and then you go to the lockers. Now, you can buy either a locker or a room. And I was always cheap, so I got the locker. You would take off all your clothes, put your towel on, and then you can go walk around. And then you would either go like downstairs where they had like the hot tub and the sauna and stuff like that, and that's where a lot of the action happened. Or you could go past the lockers and there was like a little TV room, and then past that was like the dark room with the glory holes and the sling, and it's very, very dark. You can't really see much of anything.
I'm a really nervous person, so like that would be scary for me, but were you scared?
I knew the risk I was taking. It wasn't necessarily a good risk, but I knew what I was doing to myself. I would say only one person probably used a condom out of everyone at the night. I didn't have the self-image that I cared enough about my body to worry about things like that. I just said, you know what, if I get it, I get it. I ended up in the sling and like guys just went back to back on me. And it's one of those things where I didn't leave there feeling happy.
After that night in the bathhouse, John realized that that experience wasn't what he was looking for.
Self to self. What the fuck are you doing? Why are you doing it? And is it healthy? And I said, no, it's not healthy. And then how do I make it healthy? Okay, well, I could stop just doing whatever everyone else wants and figure out what I want.
So you went the one time and you spent most of the night there. Did you ever go back to participate again?
Yeah, I went back, but not to the level that I did. So I was a lot more selective. Like I would kind of scope it out, talk to more people, you know, make it more of a social environment. And then I would randomly just like pick a guy and then go at it with them.
At your job, did you feel that you were able to talk about this topic?
I wanted to be open and honest with them. I told them, yeah, I was there. This is what I did. And if anyone wanted to go to the bathhouse with me, I was totally open to it. I said, I'm probably not going to participate, but if you want me there for whatever reason, moral support, for condoms, whatever it might be, I'll totally go with you. As long as it's a free night. I don't want to have to pay.
And now our Social Butterfly Award. Each year, the Social Butterfly Award goes to the team that best uses social media throughout the 24-hour scramble of creating a radio story. And this year, the award goes to a team that calls itself Mummy Daddy Media.
Although I grew up in Europe with my family, now there was an understanding between my parents and I that one day I would go back to India and I would get married to an Indian girl through the process of an arranged marriage. And over a course of 7 years, met about 35 to 40 women, and I did not agree to marry any of them.
The team produced their story, not your typical boy meets girl story, as they call it, all the way from New Delhi. Listen to their full story at kcrw.com/unfictional. And we had another new award this year, the Work It Award. Work It is WNYC's all-woman podcasting festival. It's happening this November in Los Angeles, and you can find a link to the festival on our website. And the team over there chose the winner from a batch of 5 really great Radio Race pieces made by female producers. It's a new award this year. The winners get a free pass to the festival's boot camp in October. This year's Work It Prize goes to What Lies Beneath by Team RUFSM, April Ludston and Rachel Peacock. It's the story of 2 women looking for old tunnels that run beneath part of downtown Los Angeles.
We've always been fascinated by what lies beneath the surface of a city, especially when it's steeped in mystery. We had heard these rumors about abandoned subway tunnels underneath downtown LA.
So of course we had to see these tunnels for ourselves.
Spoiler alert, they find them.
It has this feeling that lies somewhere between sanitized neglect. The fluorescent lights make it feel like a hospital, but there's nothing clean down here.
Listen to the full story at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And now, the overall second place winner, a story about taking flight. It was produced by a team called the Ruptured Burritos.
So airborne school is to prepare you for airborne military operations, which is flying over an area that is not controlled by U.S. forces, jumping out of planes, parachuting to the ground, and beginning military operations. 2012. In Georgia, it's hot. I'm in boots, full long sleeves, have a helmet on, and you're walking up to that plane, and its engines start shooting hotter air back at you. You feel wind from those engines that are spinning, and you're walking up, and somebody's counting you as you step into the back ramp is down. You get in and you're crammed in there. You're squeezed up against each other. Everybody's body is pushing everyone else. You're kind of barely getting your butt on the seat at all. And C-130s are loud. You hear a lot of spinning, kind of engine noises. And once everybody's loaded in, they close up the back and the plane starts to take off. And then you do a safety check. And then everybody down the line, safety check means you tap all your different equipment, make sure that it's buckled how it's supposed to be, where it's supposed to be. Then the jump master has the first guy move up to the door and they open the door. Stand by. And there's a red light next to it. And whenever they get the green light, he tells that first guy, green light, go. there's like a 1 second pause between, but it doesn't feel like 1 second when you got all that adrenaline going, you know? Like, you just walk up to the door, and then you step, and you free fall for somewhere between 4 and 6 seconds. And it's kind of funny, because there's that huge, like, anxiety right before you go to the door, and there's that huge adrenaline rush as you jump out and you're free-falling. But then, once your parachute's caught, it's actually really peaceful. You know, there's a period of time, I don't know, maybe a minute, that you're just sort of floating in the air, and you have this really cool view of the ground below you, and you can see for a long ways. It's gentle. It's peaceful. I think I always pictured myself being a soldier at some point. I watched G.I. Joe religiously as a kid. I played with the action figures. I always had toy guns, and I, like, pretended I was in the army. Also, I just wasn't that great at being a responsible person, and I knew that that was a thing that I wanted. I wanted more responsibility and accountability for myself. It's weird because you think of army people as so strict and contained, but I honestly think, like, there's a laid backness to being able to just do whatever you need to do today. And so there was that rigid militariness of this needs to be done right and it needs to be done kind of exact in a way. But there was also I come to work 8:30 in the morning and I might have paperwork thrown at me that I need to fill out and get done for somebody. Or I might be packing a range bag and driving out to shoot guns in an hour. That's part of, I think, what honestly does make airborne units stand out, is the people there are people who are willing to do something a little crazy. I guess in a way, that's a way that we prove it to ourselves, is jumping out of the planes. Then you start to get close to the ground, and you realize you're about 50 feet off the ground, and that's when you have to start getting ready to land, and there's sort of an oh shit moment again, where you're like, I'm about to hit the ground, I'm about to hit it pretty hard. When I was walking back, I was sort of like, oh, wow, we just did this. You know, like, I just did that. That's awesome.
With over 100 entries, it was obviously difficult to narrow the winners down. And that's why each year I choose one story out of the Radio Race entries to feature on the program that represents the unfictional vibe. This year, the unfictional pick is a story about love and the KGB. Here's an excerpt from their story.
I was the third person to leave the country under such unusual circumstances, and the first person was the daughter of Stalin.
It's the story of a couple who met in the USSR and not long after got married.
But he was very, very skinny, and he really had pimples, but huge big eyes and very kind of red, juicy lips.
What's unusual is they didn't get married for love, or at least not just for love, but so they could leave the country. And they did.
And I started to think, well, I'll never see this girl again unless I marry her. Because you just don't get your fiancé out of Russia in 1966. I mean, you don't even get your children out of Russia. I got on my knees and I said, I wouldn't really want to marry you if we were together in America, but I need to marry you for us to be together, and so I'm asking you to marry me.
This is really weird. I don't know whether it's an American way. It's really weird. But I liked the honesty. We were kind of making our own rules. I knew that I would never get bored with him.
You can hear the whole story on our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. The story is called CCCP Love Story, and it was produced by Maya Croth. And it's the Radio Race Unfictional pick. And now it's time to present the first place winner. It's interesting that this year our second and first place winning stories were both about different dramatic kinds of trips. The last story took us up into the sky, and this one takes us out into a different kind of unknown, the deep, dark ocean, specifically the Bermuda Triangle. Here's a clip.
We've come to the point where you lose the Miami skyline for this.
We are going to jump into the abyss right now and swim down as far as you can and look up.
So how deep is it here?
3,500 feet. Are you ready?
Yeah.
If I don't come back up in 5 minutes, home's that way.
It's a piece called Deep Blue, made by Wilson Sayre and Chris Barr. And when we called them up to ask about the piece, they were getting ready to confront nature in a totally different way. They live in Florida and were preparing for Hurricane Irma.
We are currently in evacuation zone C, which is currently under a mandatory evacuation order. We're right on the Miami River, a couple miles off of the coast of Miami. And we're looking a couple days away from Hurricane Irma touching down here.
Wilson's a reporter for the local public radio station and said they were preparing to go hunker down in a shelter to report on the storm.
We'll be safe, but we will be riding out the storm with many, many other people who aren't able to get out or who choose not to get out.
Wilson and Chris said that when they heard the theme, they knew who to call, who among their friends and acquaintances would be up to something, and who they could go along for the ride with.
Really, we let the theme sort of take us wherever it would take us. My neighbor here along the river is another guy named Chris, and he's just sort of a local sort of character, a real sort of Florida guy, if you will. So the idea was just basically put ourselves in Chris's hands.
Which is sort of a scary prospect sometimes.
Sometimes you don't know where that ends up.
So it wasn't entirely surprising where that ride ended up taking them, the Bermuda Triangle.
And the other thing is, like, we were going to the Bermuda Triangle, which has this sort of crazy lore about it, especially in South Florida. I don't know if that carries outside of this area. So we didn't know what we were going to find. And I think sort of the beauty that we did see, I felt was very unlike Chris, the neighbor. And I felt sort of... that his appreciation of this place really made me understand, maybe understand a new part of this person who I thought was pretty sort of unsentimental. And I really like that.
Oh, he's so sentimental about the sea, though.
I guess so. But I've never experienced that with him. And that was sort of special.
Yeah.
And here's the dreamy, mysterious, prize-winning piece that came out of it. From Wilson Sayre and Chris Barr, Deep Blue.
We're down for whatever. Whatever, whatever?
Yeah.
Really? Well, let's just do a little quick search of the weather.
This is Chris, my neighbor. We're not sure what he does, but he's a reliable character.
And he has a boat.
Can you tell us what we need to bring?
Shorts. And a bathing suit. We could do that. We could go, like, right to the middle of the Devil's Triangle.
Chris calls it the Devil's Triangle. Most people probably know it as the Bermuda Triangle, which is the area between Miami to the west, Puerto Rico to the south, and Bermuda to the north.
Okay, yeah. We need beer.
Sunscreen!
Got it. Wait, no, that's nasal mist. All right, we're coming. So, what's the theory about the Devil's Triangle? Like, we've all heard about it, but, like, what?
I truly believe it's aliens, for sure. Yeah, definitely aliens.
No, really, come on.
No, really, I'm telling you. They could say the magnetic this and the that, but really, the amount of ships and planes that have been lost there, and I personally have seen aliens out there, so.
Chris, come on.
You asked me my theory.
Yeah, no, you've personally seen aliens out there?
Well... not exactly, but they could have been. They were unidentified, okay? Come on, let's go. We're losing daylight. The weather started getting rough. The tiny ship was tossed. If it weren't for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost. Well, I'm definitely Gilligan.
We're hoping you're the skipper.
Okay, we are halfway across in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle.
Not actually in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. We're in the triangle, halfway to the Bahamas, 20 miles off the coast of Miami.
We've come to the point where you lose the Miami skyline for this.
We are going to jump into the abyss right now and swim down as far as you can and look up.
So how deep is it here?
3,500 feet. Are you ready?
Yeah.
If I don't come back up in 5 minutes, home's that way. Go! Solid blue.
This is what Chris brought us to the middle of the ocean to see, the color blue. When you dive down 10 feet and look up,
in the water, you're surrounded by a solid wall of indigo. It glows somehow.
This is purple. I mean, the sun is not on it right now, but I call it purple.
Tiny little fish will pop out of the mass of color, seemingly out of nowhere, and you realize how vast it all is.
It's here where you finally realize what they mean by the deep blue sea.
And deep it is.
What is whale. That?
What was that?
That
oh
was
my
a whale.
God.
Where? You're kidding me.
It was
here.
A whale.
Wow.
Oh my
God. I told you there's whales out here. Just keep an eye over there. Don't
go back. Cool. Glad I didn't sit on the couch all day.
That was Deep Blue, the winner of this year's 24-hour radio race. Thanks to our judges, Jesse Thorne, Ava Carrillo, Eleanor McDowell, Nadia Raymond, and Kelly McEvers, and to the KCRW producers and staff who helped listen to all the entries. You can find photos, links, and other information about this episode at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And while you're there, you can find an archive of all the past episodes of this program. We have new podcast episodes of Unfictional on the way, including produced just for Unfictional, an oral history of Jubilee, Derek German's original punk movie from 1979.
I think there's a story that Jordan carved something with a razor blade in Adamant's back, so that when he was walking around, he had cut in writing on his back.
He came to the shop one day. I thought it would be a good idea to get a Stanley knife and carve fuck into his back as a sort of real-life tattoo. You know, he did nearly faint. I haven't inspected his back recently, but I think it's probably still
there. Plastic surgery.
You're signed up.
That's coming soon. We're on Twitter at Unfictional and on Facebook, too. Be sure to follow us there. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. Carla Green produced this episode. Please join us next time for Unfictional on KCRW.com.